Welcome back to the Daily Drum on 96.3 WHUR and Sirius XM Channel 141. I'm Bramante Bryant, in for Harold Fisher. This is the Insight segment. We'll call it Super Tuesday again today in Missouri, Kansas, Michigan, Arizona, and the states of Washington, where people are heading to the polls or the mailbox to cast their in-person or mail-in ballots to decide the Republican and Democratic nominees for congressional and state offices. As they do, how many of them, or even us, give thought to the 15th and 19th Amendments to the Constitution, both profoundly affecting voting in the United States, especially as it relates to African Americans? This year marks the 150th and 100th anniversary of the historic amendments. Tonight, we're talking about that history and what it means for African American voters today. If you have a question or comment, the phone lines are open. We'd love to hear from you. 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. Tonight, your vote counts and your comments count too. So we want to hear from you. Give us a call. Our guest tonight, Belethia Watkins, Dr. Watkins, that is, and she is an associate professor in the Department of Afro-American Studies at Howard University, and Niambi Carter, Professor Carter, associate professor in the Department of Political Science. Again, the phone lines are open, 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Dr. Watkins, let's start with you. For those who don't know what the 15th and 19th Amendments are, and I'm going to guess most folks don't know, what are they?
Good evening. It's good to join you this evening. The 15th Amendment, which was passed in 1870, basically states that the right of citizens to vote shall not be denied or abridged on account of race, color, or previous condition of servitude. So that is the amendment that said that people could not be discriminated against when setting voter qualifications. Now, that amendment is often misunderstood. You commonly hear people say that it gave black men the right to vote, and only black men, and that it did not include women. But that is coming from the perspective of the white women's suffrage movement, because it deals with discrimination based on race, and say you cannot deny a person the vote based on race. It does cover black women. And we could talk more about that later, but I will say it is because of the 15th Amendment that we're dealing with only voter suppression now, as opposed to an outright ban or disenfranchisement of black people based on race or minorities based on race. That is what is standing between total disenfranchisement. Mm-hmm. And then the 19th Amendment is basically the same language as the 15th Amendment, except for it says you cannot deny a citizen their right to vote on account of sex. And again, it is an amendment that people often say guarantees women the right to vote, but it does not guarantee all women the right to vote. It doesn't guarantee any women the right to vote. It did end the fight for voting rights for white women, but it did not end the fight for the right to vote for black women. So they are celebrating 100 years of enfranchisement of voting. For black women, we mark our legally protected right to vote with the passage of the 1965 Voter Rights Act. And that is the law that allowed black women to have access to the poll, and primarily black people too. And so for black women, although white women are celebrating 100 years of access to the ballot, black women have merely had the vote for 55 years.
And so in theory, right, literally in theory, those amendments should have, especially the 19th Amendment, allowed black women to vote. But if I'm hearing you correctly, on paper it says, okay, you're a woman, you cannot now discriminate based on gender. But if I'm understanding what you're saying, though, in literally when black women try to vote, you know, different mechanisms were put up to prevent them from being able to use the franchise, which legally they should have been able to. Would that be correct?
Right. So in theory, in practice, what happened is that they used the same devices, literacy tests, poll taxes, violence to stop black people from voting. But it also has something to do with how the Supreme Court interpreted both laws. So both the 15th Amendment and the 19th Amendment, well, under the 14th Amendment, were challenged in the court. And the court literally said in three major cases that the 15th Amendment doesn't give anyone the right to vote. And so basically how the courts are interpreting those amendments is that it's not conferring a right to vote. A right to vote is not inherent to citizenship. It's saying that what those amendments does is stop states from discriminating when they're setting voter qualifications. Mm. So for the 15th Amendment, for example, whatever qualifications they set on its face, it has to appear to be racially neutral. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't foreclose all other ways to target black people without it just foreclosed being explicit. You can't just say whites only can vote or no blacks can vote.
So we're talking 1870, 15th Amendment ratified, 1920, the 19th Amendment ratified. So again, 150 and 100 years ago. And now here we are in 2020, Dr. Carter, and we are still talking about voting, African Americans, the importance of that vote, possible suppression of that vote in 2020. So now let's move into the present. So those 15th and 19th amendments are really still relevant in a sense today based on the way Dr. Watkins has set it up, because though we all have the right to vote, will we all be able to exercise the right to vote, especially African-American communities? Talk a little bit about what's happening today in terms of voting in African Americans.
Well, I think what Dr. Watkins was getting to is that you don't really have any protection of voting rights for black people writ large until you get the Voting Rights Act of 1965.
Mm-hmm.
And what we see with the Voting Rights Act of 1965 is essentially it is covering states. So what coverage means is that any time that a state wants to change anything about the manner of election, the time, the date, they have to go to the Department of Justice for preclearance to do that. Well, ever since the Shelby County v. Holder decision in 2013, we've seen a steady rollback mm-hmm. in voting rights, which is why states can close polling places, which is why they can shorten the time to early voting if they allow early voting at all, right? All of these efforts to suppress black votes, but not just black, of course, Native American, Latinx people also, happen because that additional federal protection is no longer there. And if we've learned anything, not just from the passage of the 15th and 19th Amendments, but also a steady stream of Supreme Court cases, is that the right to vote is not an affirmative one. We mm-hmm. think we have the right to vote because we are citizens, but we also know that states have the right to determine who is eligible to mm-hmm. vote. Mm-hmm. So that's why there's this big brouhaha currently in Florida, and why LeBron James is raising money in Florida so that returning citizens who had their right to vote restored but are now being told by the state that they have to satisfy all fines in order to be registered to vote is so significant and so important, because essentially that is what some are arguing, another kind of poll tax.
Poll tax, right, yeah.
Right, and the poll tax, I mean, it's worth noting, is banned by the 24th Amendment, right, and that doesn't happen until 1964.
Mm-hmm.
So these are very present kinds of concerns that people have and should have in 2020, because all of this happens because there's really no federal framework
mm-hmm.
in place to protect voting rights right now.
And is this the conversation, Dr. Watkins and Dr. Carter, I'll let either one of you jump in, on you hear much about with the passing of John Lewis, the way to really honor him, many are saying, is to go back and re-up the Civil Rights Act and put it under his name. Talk a little bit about that. I hope I'm tracking on the right issue here. And Dr. Carter, you were talking about that. Is that what that is about?
Well, in part, because one of the really critical parts of the Voting Rights Act was the coverage formula. And the coverage formula has been ruled unconstitutional, right?
Mm-hmm.
What the Supreme Court said was that it was no longer in keeping with our current condition, so that what Congress would need to do is rewrite the section that made a jurisdiction a covered jurisdiction. So far, Congress has not done that, right? So mm-hmm. for 7 years now, we have been voting in elections without the full protection of the Voting Rights Act. And now this coverage formula, that is, states that have a history of discriminating against voters, and it's not just black voters, right? It's mm-hmm. Native American voters. It's mm-hmm. Asian voters. It's Latino voters. It's people with limited English proficiency, right? All of these different kinds of ways that people get their votes taken in a really systematic fashion could be addressed with a different formula. And Representative Sewell of Alabama had come up with a formula to talk about how jurisdictions could be covered, and yet Congress has not acted on it. And you have a real, I think, reticence by that body, in part because Republicans have been doing very well across this country, particularly in down-ballot races. So I'm talking about state legislative races and congressional races, by leaving this formula unaddressed. And that essentially takes the teeth out of the Voting Rights Act.
If I may jump in, I would say, and mm-hmm. that was a very cynical Supreme Court decision in 2013. So here you have Shelby County, Alabama, which had a history of discriminating against voters. And then you have the first black United States Attorney General, Eric Holder, being sued, basically saying that the conditions of that led to the Voting Rights Act are no longer applicable. Mm-hmm. And it was done under a black president, Obama, and there was the notion that there was such high turnout by minorities in the 2008 and 2012 elections that this law was no longer needed. So it was cynical in a sense that a Republican-controlled Congress was not going to be interested in restoring the Voting Rights Act. So, yes, that John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act, which is the name that they conferred to the act trying to restore the Voting Rights Act, is critically important.
And I guess that's, too, where we get into the issue of elections coming up in November. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Tonight we're talking about elections, voting, history, the 15th, 19th Amendments, how it relates to voting today. Phone lines are open. We'd like to hear from you. What do you think about voting? Do you plan to vote? Are you concerned about voter suppression wherever you may live? 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Dr. Watkins, I want to talk a little bit about, and I'm probably going to keep 15th and 19th Amendment somewhere hovering over this conversation. And when we think of the 19th Amendment and we think of suffrage and we think of women, we know that black women were involved in the suffrage movement, but in many ways they were sort of marginalized in the movement and had to pull together their own organizations to have their voices heard, because they had a double whammy they were dealing with, right? Race and gender. And oftentimes that was minimized in the larger sort of, if you would call it, white women movement for suffrage. Talk a little bit about that and how those tentacles still are out there today, and with African-American voters on the female side.
Yes, from the very beginning, black women were on the front lines fighting for political equality, fighting against the injustices faced in this country by many disenfranchised groups, black people as a whole and black women, and white women also. But they did so with a all-of-the-above type strategy. They did not see the issue of women's right to vote to the predominantly white women's suffrage organizations. Now, they were discriminated against in those organizations. They weren't always welcome to participate, but that didn't stop them from forming organizations like the National Association of Colored Women, mm-hmm. which had a suffrage department. And many of its leaders, like Mary Church Carroll, were very much prominent suffragists. They gave speeches. They were able to, we did send ambassadors to some of those organizations that gave speeches and participated in different activities, but that was more the exception than the rule. So you had people like Ida B. Wells that formed the Alpha Suffrage Club in 1913. Mm-hmm. And probably one of the most retold story is the 1913 Women's Suffrage March here in Washington, D.C., where the students from Howard University were the only black organization, Delta Sigma Theta, to be represented in that march. They were led by Mary Church Terrell, but Ida B. Wells, coming from Chicago with the Alpha Suffrage Club, was asked to march at the back of the march, which was segregated by race because the Southern women threatened to boycott the march if black women were allowed to participate. And so Ida B. Wells flatly refused to go to the back of the parade. And she basically said, I take this stand on account of the principle, because if we give in to this principle, then we will, you know, be caving into segregation and racism. Mm-hmm. And so it's important that we take this stand. So ultimately, right. In the end, the famous story is that she, when the march got underway, she took her rightful place at the front with the Illinois delegation, defying them and daring them to try to remove her from that place. So there is a lovely picture of her in her full sash right up front where she wanted to be.
All right. And her story, obviously, and the way you told it so well, just about voting, but she's so well known about her anti-lynching campaign. And so it's important that you add that all of those things are connected in that story that you just shared. I want to try to get a phone call in before we take a break on the other side, and I want to get a call from Loris calling from Baltimore. Go right ahead, Loris, with your question or comment.
Good evening, everyone. Yes, I'm going to vote. I haven't missed a vote since I was 18 years old, and I'm now 67. So, with that said, my question is, what will the John Lewis, I don't know if it's an amendment, a bill, I don't know what to call it, that advancement, what will it actually do? Will it cover all the inequities that are currently in the bills that are out there now or amendments? And if it is passed, will it impact the 2020 election?
Okay, Loris, you hang on right there because we're going to take a break, and I'm going to let the good doctors address your question, but I want to make sure that they have enough time to get it in. So stay right on the line, Loris, and we'll get back to you after this quick timeout. Also, if you're on the line, stay right there. We will continue this conversation on SiriusXM Channel 141. Phone lines are open, 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. I'm Bramante Bryant, in for Harold Fisher. The original Quiet Storm with John Mons is next on 96.3 WHUR. Welcome back to The Daily Drum on HUR Voices, SiriusXM Channel 141. I'm Bramante Bryant, in for Harold Fisher. This is the Insight segment. Tonight we're talking about voting. We're less than 100 days away from the presidential elections. In some states today, there is voting in congressional and state elections. So voting is everywhere, and we know the president has been talking about mail-in voting and absentee voting and whether or not that is good or bad. Obviously, he believes it's bad, except in Florida, as he announced today. But we'd like to hear from you. We're talking also about the connection of the historic 15th and 19th Amendments, which are celebrating 150th and 100-year anniversaries. Phone lines are open, 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Dr. Carter, Loris was asking, and I know both of you kind of addressed it a little bit, about she wanted to know if this new named legislation, if it does come to the fore for John Lewis and the Civil Rights Bill, what it will cover. Can you sort of recap that for her if you can?
Yeah, so basically the main thing it wants to do is restore Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. So under Shelby County v. Holder, the formula that was used under the Voting Rights Act initially was essentially if you had, I think it was less than 50% of the black population in your jurisdiction registered to vote, then you would be considered a covered jurisdiction. That's why some states are covered in whole and others are just covered in part. So a state like North Carolina, Durham wasn't covered because Durham had already met that threshold by the time the Voting Rights Act was passed. So what this would do was essentially put back in force Section 5 by saying the covered jurisdictions, we won't use those census numbers anymore. What we will use is whether that locality has had any violation of the 14th or 15th Amendments in the last 20 years. And what it does essentially, and I'll have to check that year just to double check, it's been a minute, but what it essentially says is, So no longer will we use the census formula. We'll just use the sort of most basic part of what the Voting Rights Act was supposed to do, which is any state that has violated citizens' voting rights would be considered or be eligible to be a covered jurisdiction. What that means is that anytime they want to change their district boundaries, anytime they want to make any changes in the qualifications to vote, any of the languages available, voting material available in multiple languages, anytime they want to change any of that, they would need to go to the Department of Justice. So things that we're seeing right now with reduction and consolidation of voting locations, for example, those would, again, have to go through the Department of Justice, and they have done kind of two things at once, which is reconstitute the really essential parts of Section 5, but given, again, a new formula for how we would determine which jurisdictions are covered, as opposed to the old formula, which the Supreme Court rejected.
Lois.
Her other part of her question, was whether it would be in play by the 2020 election.
Yes.
Unfortunately, no.
Lois, Dr. Carter broke it down. I hope you could take all that in, and that does that answer your question?
I didn't hear the first part. Thank you very much.
Okay.
I hope everybody does go out and vote. This is a critical election this year.
Well, thank you so
much. I hope people do not do the wrong thing and not vote.
Thank you
very much for having the show.
Thank you, Loris, and we're glad you're going out to vote. And Dr. Watkins, Loris took me right in to my next question now. Voting in African Americans. We can go back to 2016, right? We can see, what was it, Wisconsin, Michigan, was it Pennsylvania?
Pennsylvania.
Yeah, the under 10% for Trump, and we saw the decrease in African-American voters. Are we expecting to see the same in this election? And what are your thoughts on the temperament, the thoughts, and I'm going to get to you, Dr. Carter, on that also, on African-American voting in this election? What's your sense?
Well, I think what is critically important and what the national news or corporate media didn't speak enough about was that the decrease that we saw was directly related to the loss of protection of the Voter Rights Act.
Mm-hmm.
And so
not so much apathy, because that's really the main narrative that has been put
right,
out, correct?
That is the narrative that was given, but as President Obama said at John Lewis' funeral, with surgical precision, they could target the vote. So you don't have to say no blacks should vote or no minorities should vote. If you shave off 5,000 in this district or county, a couple of hundred in that county, you get the result, the Electoral College victory that he got, which was only 70,000 votes in the Electoral College that led to the presidency, even though Hillary Clinton in the popular vote, had 3 million more votes. And so that's that surgical precision and that targeting of people with the lack of protection of the Voting Rights Act. So understand that 2016 was the first election without the protection, a presidential election without the protection of the Voting Rights Act.
And can I add to
sure.
To that what we saw in 2016 and sort of the roadmap to the removal of the teeth of Section 5 really started in 2010.
Mm-hmm.
Part of what happened is that we were not paying enough attention to down ballot races.
Hmm.
And Republicans knew that.
Mm-hmm.
And what they did very well, and why they're a lot better at gerrymandering than we have been, and now, of course, we're paying attention to, is that if you can turn a few key states and turn those legislatures
mm-hmm.
red,
mm-hmm.
you can control a lot of the outcomes because, again, voting happens at the state level.
Mm-hmm.
The time and manner of elections is set by the state, not mm-hmm. the federal government.
Right.
And so they were sort of really projecting for a decade out what they would need to do to remain viable.
Hmm.
And so one of the things that we have to continue to do is, while we talk about voting in presidential elections, is please do not forget your state elections. State legislatures determine voting districts at your state level, right? Those what we call gerrymanders. They're not always gerrymandered, but redistricting is a mandatory process that happens every decade.
Mm-hmm.
Who is in charge in your state legislature matters. We saw it in North Carolina. We've seen it in Wisconsin. We see it in New York State. It's really important. And so I think while we talk about voting a lot at the presidential election time, because, of course, those are the sexiest, largest elections.
Right.
The state elections are really consequential. And, you know, thinking about our voting rights, we have to not just take a federal look. We have to also look at our state legislatures and take those midterm elections just as seriously as we do those presidential elections.
And DeAndrea, I know you're on the line. We're going to get to you, but I just wanted to piggyback Dr. Carter your point real quick, because, you know, it came out, I think, maybe late yesterday, but we mentioned it today in the newscast, how the Census Bureau will be ending their count a month early, and how that could affect the count in predominantly areas of color. And can you address that? And you also, Dr. Watkins, the importance of the census and how who has the levers of power can sort of shorten that count. Instead of ending in October, now it's going to end in September. And what can that mean? Dr. Carter, if you could sort of dig into that.
Well, I mean, there are still over, you know, I think 60 million households or something that are unaccounted for. And we know that we have a very political and a politicized moment. The census is typically viewed as sort of a hands-off thing.
Mm-hmm.
But we know that if we take this census data now and we think about who's counting and who is going to be counted, again, that's going to influence how electoral districts get drawn
right.
at the state level. So in some cases, right, it's going to be of benefit to undercount in our communities. And of course, you know, I think for many people this was really jarring because the Bureau made an abrupt sort of about face when they were talking about they needed more time because of the pandemic to count. And now that we have the director of the Bureau essentially saying that we're going to be okay with the incomplete count is going to be, I think, potentially devastating, because there are essentially going to be parts of the country and Americans who don't exist, right? They legitimately will not show up. And so for those who are interested in trying to advocate for disadvantaged communities, not having this data is going to be critically hurtful to their activities.
Dr. Watkins, should there be more of an uproar about this census issue?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And we need to urge all of the communities of color and everybody to fill out that census. It determines resources, allocation of resources, but it's going to have a significant it is part of the strategy for voter suppression and for the dilution of the power and strength of minority communities' votes. And so it is very much tied up with that. And then there have been Supreme Court decisions that said partisan gerrymandering, it's not something the courts should get involved in. It's something that the legislature will need to deal with. And so that would allow it, you know, you weren't supposed to do it based on race, but partisanship also becomes a proxy for race in many respects, because, you know, certain groups of communities vote largely Democrat.
Mm-hmm.
So it becomes a proxy for disenfranchising them if you draw the districts in very constrained ways to try to dilute the concentration of voters. So it is just another prong of voter suppression and disenfranchisement that is critically important. We need to fight it on all levels if we want one person, one vote to count in this country.
202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Tonight we're talking about voting, the importance of it, historically what it's meant specifically for African Americans, and we're tying it also to the anniversaries of the 15th and 19th Amendments. Let's go back to our phone lines real quick, and DeAndrea calling from the district. Go right ahead with your question or comment.
Okay, hello. Yes,
hello.
DeAndrea. My comment is really dealing with the 14th and the 15th Amendment. And I just feel that both of them are unconstitutional because it basically asserts that race still matters. Therefore, the term black has no nation or place in the Constitution because it was written for white men. So to refer to us in there as previous slaves or previous servants or otherwise, or those who have been given these rights, would still infer that we're still those people, which obviously we're not. So if we're citizens, that should be removed. We should be included as we the people. How can Black Lives Matter if the Supreme Court goes by the letter of the law? So, you know, from my perspective,
if it said previous servitude, then it's not saying that they're still slaves, right? So it's saying previous. Isn't that the operative word? Because it sounds like you're using previous to say that it would still be the status of African Americans. So I'm a little confused on your point there.
It's a term that's very loose. In the Constitution, when they're dealing with the law, they deal with the actual laws. You have your amendments and you have your laws. Those amendments can be, ratifications and those things can be amended. Those can be taken away. They can be changed. So again, I was stating that it should be, some changes to the actual constitutional law to include us as we the people. Because at this point, the reason black lives don't matter is because we're not in the letter of the law. And there is no nation called black. You know, we're Africans or we're, Asians or we're Mexicans or Latinos, but there's no black nation. That's why I think that those things, once it reaches the Supreme Court, are undermined. There's no rights for that term. There's rights for what the actual Constitution says.
Okay, thank you. So I think we got it. Even though there's no black nation appears in the Constitution, I don't know if one of the doctors want to jump in on that.
I think I get where she was trying to go.
Okay.
I think the point is there is no, once these amendments happen, I don't know if she was seeing the amendments as somehow separate from the rest of the body of the Constitution.
Right.
But they are part of the Constitution.
Correct.
No, it doesn't mention black people by name. It says race, color, or previous condition of servitude, which
correct.
Technically could apply to anyone.
That's right.
I think, this is sort of Malcolm X's point. If we were citizens, we wouldn't need these laws.
Right.
And I think that's true. But, I think the one thing that we should take from this moment is that we don't want our rights to be left up to fiat and left up to, popular convention. Because if some people had their druthers, we would still have no rights. Mm-hmm. And so, you don't want to leave it up to tradition or assume that people read We the People, and that means black people, because it has not always been the case that We the People includes black people. And I think there's a lot of debate about whether those terms actually include black people now. So you don't want to leave it up to chance, because we can see with all the laws that we do have, whether it's amendments to the Constitution or actual congressional legislation, that black rights are not a settled issue in this country, and they're still a consistent fight. And so part of what we have had to take away, I hope we've taken away from this last decade, is that, democracy is an action, right? As John Lewis said in his famous letter, it's an action, it's not a state.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's something that you have to strive for, and it's something you have to fight for. It's not fair. It doesn't feel good, and it certainly is not what people would rather be spending their efforts on. But it is vitally important, right, to our health as a community and our health as a nation, that we don't let those things just sort of wither on the vine and assume somebody else is going to look out for our interests.
Mm-hmm.
It's something that we have to consistently come back to, and we have to protect with the veracity, right, if we are going to hang on to what we have. And
all
then
right.
Make it more robust for other people.
Well, we're going to talk about that robustness, if that is a word. And I've got the doctors in the house. They'll tell me in the break if it is or isn't. And we're going to talk about Black Lives Matter and its impact on voters and this election this year. A little bit of that, a little bit more of your calls. 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. This is the Insight segment. We'll be right back after this quick break. Welcome back to the Daily Drum on HUR Voices, Sirius XM Channel 141. I'm Bramante Bryant in for Harold Fisher. This is the Insight segment. And tonight we're talking about voting, African Americans going to the polls, the importance of their vote. And we're also talking about the history of voting, 15th and 19th Amendments. 15th Amendment, 150 years old this year. The 19th Amendment, 100 years old this year, and what all of that means for African Americans. Dr. Watkins, Juan Williams, he's not seen as a liberal, but he wrote a column about a month ago, and he said the black vote now defines American politics. Would you agree with that?
Well, I would say that, you know, the in a symbolic sense of saying, is the country going to really live up to the principle that it states? I think the previous caller was speaking to the notion of white supremacy and the fact that you have all of these laws. If we were treated as true citizens, then why would we have to have all these additional laws to try to just have the most fundamental basic rights of citizenship? But I will say this, that the Democratic Party has relied heavily on the black vote to elect its candidates and to be in a position that it is now. Like Joe Biden's candidacy was in deep trouble until black women and the black voters of South Carolina stepped in. And so in relying on the black vote to advance its interests as a party, it is now time for the party to look at the people who are really supporting that party and giving it the political power that it has. So I would say that when you talked before about Black Lives Matter, we have to take all of the approaches necessary. We can't just rely on one thing. So we need to vote like our lives depend on it, because it does, in the fact that we're in an unprecedented, once-in-a-century global pandemic. We have this year, not many people have talked about it as much as they should, a record number of black women running for Congress. So we had about 122 black women at least to throw their hat in the ring. And so this is an opportunity to elect an unprecedented number of black women in Congress. You know, in the 2018 election, they elected a record number of women to the Congress. So that it's not just to be passive in the process to vote, but also we're talking about political representation and the right to be leaders, to be at the table. And so this is a unique opportunity to celebrate those amendments by, you know, potentially selecting a black woman as a vice presidential candidate, and to be at the table, to make the political decision, not just always lobbying those in power, but to be in power, to make the decision. And when we are, we tend to look out for humanity and do the right thing across the board.
Dr. Carter, what role do you see Black Lives Matter and those ancillary groups to, or, you know, those that are similar to Black Lives Matter, not just strictly Black Lives Matter, but if we just look at it broadly, what role do you think they are playing, will play, as we get closer to the presidential election in November?
Well, one of the things they've been doing is registering people to vote, both in person at protests, but also online. And I think that's really important. They've been, Black Lives Matter organizations have been handing out guides to help people make voting decisions, right? So who are the politicians who are like-minded? But I think probably one of the biggest things that Black Lives Matter has done, and probably one of their biggest contributions, is actually pushing the needle on public opinion. That is not something we have seen. I don't know if it's just because the pandemic and people are home and forced to watch night after night.
Right.
But we've actually seen people actually start to believe black people when they say that they are being mistreated by the police and other law enforcement. And I think that's tremendous, because before this, I don't know that that was even part of the conversation, that you had black people who believed this. You even had some Latino people who believed this. But you really didn't have white people believing this. And so I think that they have pushed public opinion and made this a national conversation, police brutality, a national conversation in ways that it has not been before. And even having localities talk about things like defunding the police for the first time, right? Talking about not just lowering the budgets, but actually maybe decreasing the size of forces. In some places, even talking about disbanding police forces, not saying that they won't have any kind of security, but let's rethink what we call this agency and this institution. And I think that's tremendous. And I don't think we've seen anything like it, you know, since the civil rights period in the late 1960s, that this has not been there has not been a movement as, I think, galvanizing and as effective since then. So I think the Black Lives Matter movement deserves a lot of credit for beginning a lot of really important conversations, and probably have emboldened places like Asheville, North Carolina, to talk about reparations,
right,
in a real way, and move down that line. Because now I think there are a lot more possibilities now that everybody is quote unquote woke and paying attention.
Right. In our last few minutes, I would like to get both of the good doctors to comment on this, and Dr. Watkins, you had already scratched the surface a little bit. We know it's going to be probably at least another 2 weeks before, or at least a week and a half maybe, before Joe Biden announces his vice presidential pick. And Dr. Watkins, you talked about the importance of having black females as viable candidates and right up on his list, and many would say Kamala Harris is at the top of the list. So I'd like to ask you both. Number one, how important, what it means that they're being considered, and what it would mean if he doesn't pick an African-American woman. I think we've talked a lot about what it would mean if he picked one, but what would it mean if he didn't pick one? Dr. Carter.
Well, I think if he doesn't pick one, it would be a slap in the face to many black women, because black women have single-handedly saved the Democratic Party's butt in a number of cases.
Right.
I mean, that's not putting too fine a point on it. I mean, whether you're talking about Doug Jones in Alabama or you're talking about black women helping to turn the tide in South Carolina for the Biden campaign, black women have shown up over 90%, right, super majorities of black women over and over again in statewide and in national races. So I think it is time for the Democratic Party to acknowledge the leadership that black women have on the ground with the leadership they have in the highest of offices, because we know one of the things that the Democratic Party has not done well is promote black women's leadership, even though black women are who the Democratic Party is. That is the future of the Democratic Party in a lot of ways, are black women. And whether you're talking about organizations like Higher Heights or Fair Fight Georgia, right, black women are doing the work on the ground to make the Democratic Party viable statewide and nationally. So it's important, I hope. I mean, we also acknowledge that there are at least the names of, you know, five black women in circulation in this conversation around, I think it's as much as six, right, around the vice presidency, right? So not just Senator Harris, but Susan Rice, Keisha Lance Bottoms, Stacey Abrams, Val Demings, Karen Bass. We've never had a conversation about black women at the head of the political table in this way. So I think the Democratic Party needs to really dig deep and do some soul searching. Because if they don't pick a black woman, I think this will, I don't think turn black women away, because I think black women understand the stakes. That we don't have the privilege of just not voting and not participating.
Dr. Watkins, the music is playing, so I've got about 30 seconds left, but I know you're a teacher, so I know you can summarize your thoughts on if a black woman is not picked, the importance of that.
Yeah, well, I would say that there would be no excuse for not having a black woman, that if not now, then when, that we have an embarrassment of riches, and they're all qualified. Now, there's probably one other woman, Elizabeth Warren, that if she comes in, her policy may make us, because it'll help black people, be okay.
Dr. Valathia Watkins. Valathia Watkins. I'm having problems with names today. She is an associate professor in the Department of Afro-American Studies. And Dr. Niambi Carter, associate professor in the Department of Political Science at Howard University. Thank you all both so much. Enjoyed the conversation. Fantastic discussion tonight. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's the Daily Drum for this Tuesday, August 4th. I'm Bramante Bryant in for Harold Fisher. Have a fantastic night.